defending ourselves against, as well as what, you know, the practical real world of what can you do about those particular things. So let's start with, there's a product called Iron Key. If you were to browse to your web browser and type in ironkey.com, you would find some very interesting products. And these products appear to be the only USB flash drives that are on the market today that appear to be bad USB invulnerable. So bad USB was the nasty, nasty thing that was exposed at the Black Hat conference, and it was completely stealth mode and transparent to any sort of security or antivirus scanner that was available or was known at the time. And the reason for this was because it operated literally on the USB controller communication channel, which was designed on a backplane of trust. And part of this had to do with actually then implanting the malware onto the firmware of the USB flash drive, so that then next time the USB flash drive would be connected to anything else, then that USB flash drive would load up a fake keyboard, so it would have like a keyboard emulator on it, and basically all devices are designed to say to auto detect on the USB standard, and so it says, oh, what are you that you've plugged into me? Oh, it's a keyboard. Sure, that's a keyboard. I'll take that keyboard. And then next thing you know, that keyboard is typing in commands and doing things. And so the potential existed to also have a mouse emulator, and at the speed at which these things could execute, unless you were literally staring at the computer, you would miss the less than 1 second activity that was actually visible on the screen when the malware was executing itself and infecting the computer. So once that computer was affected, then everything else that was connected was infected, and then everything else that ever got connected to that was infected, and I mean, it was just, it's horrible. So there was, for a very long time, no known protection against bad USB, and to my knowledge, there is still no known protection against bad USB that is comprised of a piece of software that you could have on your computer. Instead, there is at least some solace that you can take if you were to buy Iron Key's secure USB devices, because they've come up with a way to protect against the bad USB malware. So it says, Iron Key secure USB devices are not vulnerable to bad USB malware. And the bad USB was the first USB malware designed to attack the device itself instead of attacking the data on the device. And Iron Key writes their own controller firmware, and they also have their own digital signatures. And in the way that they've implemented this, it makes the product, their USB flash drive, immune to the bad USB threat. And what's interesting is they actually have a good USB trade-up program that allows people to purchase their USB devices at a discounted rate. And they also happen to have a whole bunch of other wonderful features about their product, such as full encryption. And then they have all kinds of other interesting tools like Iron Key Management and Access Enterprise and some other things that, you know, if you were an IT manager, you would probably be interested in such things. But even from a perspective of you're not an IT manager, you might want one of these Iron Keys. Specifically, I was thinking, let's say you're a journalist and you really need to share files quite regularly with people, and you need to make sure that your data has integrity and your USB flash drive is not becoming an attack vector against your own system, let alone the systems of the people that you're interviewing or you're sharing files with, etc. So, really, especially if you're a journalist where you're dealing with the public and a lot of diverse people all the time, then I would say most definitely it would be worthwhile to invest in one of those Iron Key secure USB devices. I do have to admit that I did not look at the pricing for these things, but the bottom line is that I'm sure that it is less expensive to buy an Iron Key secure USB device than it is to have all of your systems compromised because of bad USB and the other various nasty things that bad USB could do. I mean, just as a brief example, bad USB Trojan could actually be programmed to download something like a remote access Trojan onto your system, and or ransomware. It could be programmed to do any of those sorts of nasty things. And of course, if you don't have all of the components of the cybersecurity kill chain in place, well, then you don't really have any way to protect your systems in the way that traffic gets stopped and killed in the way that it is trying to egress, so leave your network or leave your system in order to access the rest of its payload and download it. So that's Iron Key. I thought it was fascinating. I'm very excited to see the innovation out there in the marketplace that is leading to this as an option for people. So the next thing I want to talk to you about is a 000 web host. They were breached apparently for a few years, and it has only come to light now. A 000 web host is a very, very, very popular web host due to the fact that they allow for free hosting. Now, I've never used them. I would probably never use free hosting because anytime something is free, you have to kind of ask the question, well, so how is it being paid for then? Is it, think about it like that flashlight application that is on your smartphone. That thing has spyware in it typically, and there are variants. There's so many different variants of the flashlight application that were found to be just out and outright malicious nastyware. So even at the most innocuous layer, it's checking on your data and it's serving up what it thinks is relevant advertisements to you because that's how it pays for itself. And at the other end of the spectrum, it's compromising all the data on your system and, being horrible. So either way, I'm not really a fan of either, so I'd just as soon as not, not download a free flashlight app on my phone. And the same thing applies with website hosting. I'd just as soon as pay for the website hosting than get it for free and then have it be where the company that is doing the website hosting is not properly prioritizing security. So, 000 web host, they had 13.5 million records stolen. And these records primarily comprised of the typical things you would expect. First name, last name, address, telephone number, username, and password. So, username and password being a big piece there. And they did not have two-factor authentication. And the whole username and password thing is a problem in that so many people reuse username and password. And this is why you can't do that. This is why you need to use a two-factor authentication protected password safe of some sort, and maybe that's LastPass in combination with YubiKey, or it's something. There's actually a new standard out there also called FIDO that Netflix is using, and I've got to do some research into that for you and give you an update on FIDO, as that may or may not be a viable option in some contexts. And it would be nice to know about that. So, 13.5 million records were stolen. And we have to ask the question, why? Was this preventable? If it was preventable, well, then let's learn from it and decide that we're not going to be victimized by the same sort of attack. So, this whole thing reminds me of the H.B. Gary attack. And the shock there is that H.B. Gary was an IT security firm, And in this case, 000 web host was an IT, an IT company. They were a website hosting company, so they were a technology company. And I'm typically quite horrified when any sort of technology company is not doing basic things to protect their systems from being compromised. And so, obviously there's an issue with resources, but I'm thinking to myself that this, the 000 web host was not an organization comprised of like five people. One of the interesting things with the Poodle attack and the SSL, the free OpenSSL vulnerabilities that existed is when people really dug into that, I think they found that since OpenSSL was free, it was open source, it was horrifically poorly funded. I mean, it was really, really poorly funded. And as a result, there was like five people worldwide working on it. Now, I might have my numbers off a little bit, but it certainly was not the same as if you look at DigiCert. DigiCert is a substantial company who has full-time employees that are paid, and it is their job to ensure the integrity of their systems and to ensure that when you are obtaining a certificate from DigiCert, that the certificate that you get is secure. So OpenSSL, people were all horrified about, well, why was it so insecure? Why did it have this vulnerability that it had for so long? Well, we go back to the whole thing of it was free. So yes, there is a resource problem. If this is, it's an interesting tug of war that exists because there's a lot of us in the IT world that support open source and we support freeware. And there's a lot of benefits to that. But at the same time, there is a concern associated with the security of such things. So I would just as soon as the thing have a minimal or a reasonable cost, and maybe it has a free variant that you can run for 30 to 60 days for trialware, but then you pay $30. Something like that. And then what you're doing is you're actually supporting a system that makes it so that there are some humans on the planet that you would presume are competent and that it is their job to work on that software all the time and improve it, or that system and improve it and maintain it. So, one thing that brings to my mind with regards to that is you guys may have heard me talk about how Sapien Software's website was showing up as hosting an IDS vulnerability a few weeks back, and that seems to have been addressed now. And that is because that company has people whose full-time job it is to check on such things, right? So it's really important that we're very cognizant as consumers of technology. When something is free, you really have to ask the question, is it really free? To me, this is the same as if you're going to use Gmail or Facebook or you're going to use various free things, well, what are you giving up? You need to think about that. Okay. So the way that these 13.5 million records were exploited, or they were stolen, was through a basic PHP exploit with a SQL injection attack. So the PHP exploit occurred because the website hosting company was using an old version of PHP, and therefore then it was vulnerable to a SQL injection attack. So what boggles my mind, I guess, is that here's a company that had the resources. So again, I'm not going to go beat on a company that doesn't have the resources, but if you're a company that's that big, you should have the resources, and then you should be able to properly prioritize those resources to be able to say, we should actually at least have it to be one person's job to do penetration testing on our website like once a day or something like that. There's actually there are service providers that you can hire as a company to automatically be checking the integrity of your system. You know, they're on a regular basis. So there are ways to get around that. Now, I'm not saying that's cheap. Okay, it's not cheap. I've seen pricing for some of that stuff to be in the realm of like $30,000 a month. But I'm guessing like an organization like Target, that would make sense for them because they have this huge e-commerce presence and they would want to subscribe to such a resource as that. You know, the alternative is they could just send two of their staff to OSCP certification training courses and get them certified and trained. I mean, clearly, if you're paying $30,000 a month, there's an element of it where it starts to make more sense for you to just train your own internal IT staff to handle some of these issues. All right, so moving on from that, I was looking at the breach analysis recently about where. Again, the trends are really important to understand so that you can figure out best how to try and mitigate these risks. And Trend Micro actually put out a really nice report. It's called Follow the Data: Dissecting Data Breaches. And ending up, they went through a myth debunking approach with this in order to either dispel common myths or maybe set them straight because maybe those myths existed because that's the way it used to be. And as I said, it's very important that we have an understanding for where the attractive targets are nowadays that the bad guys are taking advantage of so that we can best put our efforts in terms of mitigating that. So, myth one, number one, they say is that hacking and malware are the leading causes of data breaches. So that's actually not true. And hacking and malware tends to be the secondary leading factor, the second leading factor. And in reality, the primary attack vector, apparently 41% of all breaches are occurring due to device loss. So device loss comes in the realm of somebody's laptop, their mobile device, or just their or USB flash drives that are not encrypted appropriately. By the way, Iron Key, if you had an Iron Key USB flash drive, it's encrypted. So you can eliminate that as an issue. These days, I just don't understand why mobile devices aren't encrypted all the time. It does cause some challenges in terms of being able to do disaster recovery on those, but your disaster recovery approach just really needs to be, okay, well, there shouldn't be anything that is authoritative on that mobile device. What we really need to have is a situation where that mobile device is an encrypted endpoint that is secured and network access protected, and there's product on that endpoint that handles, you know, DLP loss or, you know, encryption rules and a variety of things to ensure that data isn't leaking because of that endpoint. And so since 41% of the data that's being lost, these breaches, is happening from endpoint loss or device loss, then this is enormous. I mean, if you can eliminate that effectively by just encrypting the heck out of everything, then why wouldn't you do it? And this is, as a consumer, you need to be very aware of the necessity of high quality encryption because the governments of the world are really attacking encryption as something that they say that they need to have a backdoor into. And if the government has a backdoor into an encryption protocol, well, then the bad guys also have a backdoor into the encryption protocol. And I'm not equivalating the bad guys with government. I'm just saying that if an encryption protocol has any level of weakness in it, someone will find a way to exploit it. So what's really best is that all of the stuff is as encrypted as is possible, and if the government does need to actually get access to something, then the government should, you know, they've, I believe they already have all the tools in the toolbox in order to be able to get court orders, you know, subpoenas and so forth to be able to get data. But in the meantime, the devices need to be heavily encrypted, and there needs to be remote wipe capabilities and things like that, since it's such a huge attack vector. Okay. Now, myth number two has to do with attackers are going for personally identifiable information, and they're doing that because it's the most financially viable. Well, that used to be the case, and that's no longer the case. The new thing is protected health information. So payment card data and PII in general is, and you know, the whole password data and stuff, that really is not the biggest value anymore. So there's this whole thing called the dark web or darknet, and you can just go out there for very inexpensively and purchase hundreds of thousands or millions of breached records very inexpensively when they are of the category of PII. Now, the thing that is really valuable, and so what you're looking at here is there's this glut of PII, and because of the laws of supply and demand, thank you, economics, there is very little return on investment for hackers when they're going after strictly PII. And so because of that, they find that protected health information, so their ability to steal your medical identity in order to commit insurance fraud, that is very, very valuable. Their ability to steal your identity in terms of pretending that they are you from an educational standpoint, so stealing your educational records is valuable. And then, of course, stealing your financial records, so your credit, you know, your Social Security number, your credit itself, your financial identity, access to your bank accounts, and these sorts of things. Obviously, that has substantial value. So we need to understand that those are the things that the bad guys are going after. So if you translate that into, well, what do we do about it? Well, what you do about it is that you need to make sure that you are using things like credit monitoring services, which enables you to put fraud alerts on your credit report so that people can't open accounts in your name. And credit monitoring also in terms of notifications when there are changes to your credit report of any sort. And I really strongly advise people to do their online banking from heavily secured systems. And if you're not an IT security expert, then maybe you really ought to just do your online banking from a system that is completely separate from your regular computer that you do email and web browsing from. You know, that's another way to handle it. So myth number three, using hacking or malware is the best way to steal all types of data. And this one is actually true, only because these are the most popular methods that attackers were using this past decade, you know, hacking into a network, whether using brute force or social engineering malware, literally is having the highest chance of returns. The second most preferred method turns out to be insiders. So targeting someone and then using social engineering to get them to breach willingly, so where they leak data of their own volition. And, you know, that is, in a lot of cases, kind of state actors are enticing people either with financial incentives or threats, which, I mean, that's pretty horrible that somebody would be on the receiving end of death threats against their family if they don't leak data. You know, it's kind of the whole stuff that the CIA deals with. You would think that that wouldn't apply to other people, but you'd be surprised. A network administrator who works for a telecom is a very substantial target for things like that. Now, myth number four is the retail industry is the most affected by data breaches, and that is not true. In fact, it is the healthcare sector is the highest, most affected industry of data breaches. Retailers only came in fourth place. The education sector is the second place, and government is third. And I would argue that the education sector is the second most targeted because the education sector tends to want to fly wild and open. What you have in the education sector is a bunch of teachers, especially in primary education, who want to utilize all of this content from, everywhere, hither and thither, and they tend to complain to their IT staff about, like, well, why are you blocking this and that? When in reality, the IT staff are just trying to protect them from having their systems breached. So the final myth, myth number five, is that PII is the most in-demand underground commodity in terms of breached information. So this is kind of an enhancement to what was before, but this now includes some financial figures. The surplus of PII currently available in the cybercriminal underground is the biggest factor, as I said, the economics of it. So last year it was $4 per record in terms of price, and now it's $1 per record this year. And this is also true for credit card numbers, which are now sold in bulk regardless of the card brand. So there's no longer this preference about card brands and stuff. The attempt on the payment card industry, at least in the United States, finally, I should say, I mean, in Europe, they'd been doing chip and PIN credit cards for ages now. We're finally getting chip and PIN credit cards more across the board here in the United States, which is a huge factor, given the fact that the brick and mortar transactions were really the core of the problem. When you're talking about an e-commerce credit card transaction, clearly the whole chip and PIN thing is irrelevant. But you have all of these other identifying factors like, oh, well, don't ship the product to something that's not an authorized address on that account. And, oh, well, we know you have to supply first name, last name, address, telephone number, yada, 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 yada. So there were more identifying factors. There was more way to kind of authenticate that transaction when it was being done through an e-commerce site. Alternatively, the whole brick and mortar thing was literally you're just walking up and swiping a card. And the security of that card was really exclusively based upon the cashier's diligence with regards to verifying your identity, that your driver's license photo was and name was matching what was on the credit card. Of course, if somebody had manufactured fake credit cards where they had a fake name and they had a fake identity or something like that, like if they had a fake driver's license, well, I mean, that's the game is up with that too. And that certainly has been done. So interestingly enough, here the selling of stolen Uber accounts is gaining popularity. They are now sold at around $1.15 a piece. I don't even know why they're doing that. I find that really interesting. So it's important for us to try and stay on top, even as consumers, to stay on top of where these threats are, so that we can hopefully protect ourselves from getting compromised. And of course, use different passwords everywhere and use two-factor authentication when possible. So I hope you enjoyed today's show. Always looking for your feedback, and the email address is breakfastbites@gmail.com.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the Internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at verointernationalcuisine.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs.